All right. Well, thank you so much, Daniel. It is always great to be here at PI. I mean, you know, I was a postdoc at IQC, but I also visited PI, visited Daniel, you know, before this building even existed, right, in 2002, 2003. Those were, you know, incredibly formative summers for me. I did, you know, quantum complexity theory that was about as far removed from experiment as you could possibly be. And it is, you know, immensely gratifying that the field has evolved to the point where even someone like me, who is not allowed into a lab for fear that I will just trip and, you know, break things, that we are actually, you know, in contact with experimentalists, and you know, that there is this interaction that you'll hear about today. Okay, so as Daniel mentioned, the term quantum supremacy was coined by John Preskill in 2012, although, you know, the goal itself is much older than that. In some sense, goes back to Feynman and David Deutsch and the, you know, the beginnings of quantum computing itself in the early 1980s. Okay, and you know, the question is, you know, just can you demonstrate that you can do something with a quantum computer that we're as confident as possible is classically hard? Okay, you know, I didn't notice I didn't say useful. Okay, that's basically the question that we'll be talking about. You know, and it's been all over the news just these past few months for a couple reasons. One, obviously, that Google had a paper in Nature saying that they have finally achieved this, and we're going to talk about that, about sort of exactly what they did, and, you know, what is the theoretical ground for, you know, thinking that it's a hard problem, and exactly how hard is it? Yeah, and then the other reason it was in the news was a controversy over the term quantum supremacy. That you know, some people have suggested alternatives like quantum advantage, but you know, I don't know. I feel like, you know, I mean, you know, some people have unfair advantages over other people, and that's also bad, right? And I don't know, you know, it feels like, you know, we're talking about a term for sort of one thing definitively beating another thing, and, you know, and it's sad that there's, you know, unsavory connotations, but, you know, to that, but some people suggested quantum inimitability, but I don't think anyone can pronounce that, quantum ascendancy, but that just makes it sound like we're some UFO cult, or, you know, ascending to a quantum computer in the sky. So, I'm going to stick with this term, and, you know, better it should be quantum supremacy than, you know, one of the evil kinds of supremacy that afflict our world. Okay, and So you may have seen some of the articles in the press. Like, so basically what happened was that Google, did this experiment, this, you know, quantum computational supremacy experiment involving a 53-qubit superconducting chip that they built in their lab in Santa Barbara, and they kept it under wraps. You know, they said, you know, we're not going to do science by press conference, whatever. You know, we're going to just submit our paper for, you know, peer review to Nature, and they did that. And then in October, so the paper was also had some authors from NASA, and NASA submitted it for an internal review, and then someone accidentally clicked a button and put it on their public website. And, you know, that you know, they noticed it, they took it down. It wouldn't have been such a problem, except that Google Alerts found the paper. And so, you know, Google is just too good for itself, right? And so then the Financial Times reported on it, and all these other people started reporting about it on the leaked paper, and so then Google was in this really weird situation where, you know, it was all public. People people were already start trying to, you know, rebut the paper, you know, discussing it, arguing about it. But Google was still prevented by Nature's embargo from commenting on it in public. Okay. However, I had no such limitations. So, you know, in my role as a quantum computing blogger, I did what, you know, people expect my blog to do, I guess, and just, you know, be a clearinghouse of information. You know, the Google team was even able to funnel some information through me that they could not make public. So I was a reviewer of the paper, I should say. Involved in the sort of discussions with Google back in 2015 that led to them deciding to do this in the first place, you know, that this was a sort of good thing to actually put, you know, resources, you know, into trying to achieve. And how exactly do you do it? What kind of problem do you tell your, you know, small quantum computer to do? How do you verify the results with a classical computer? Get confidence that there really was not a fast classical method to spoof the results? Okay, so these are a lot of the questions that in quantum computing theory, a bunch of us have thought about for the last decade. Okay, so basically in this talk, I'm gonna tell you the story of some of the theoretical work that we did on how do you demonstrate quantum supremacy with a near-term quantum computer, basically. How that, you know, led to the Google experiment, the responses to the experiment, the next steps after this. And then there's only like 14 slides, so hopefully there'll be plenty of time for questions and discussion. Okay, so what is the definition of quantum computational supremacy? People often get too hung up on definitions, and you know, I prefer to just talk about, you know, what has happened, or you know, what did they do and for real in the world. But let me just go over a few aspects, or you know, of ground rules of what we're talking about. By quantum computational supremacy, what John Preskill meant, and what I will mean, is the use of a quantum computer to solve some well-defined computational problem, let's say much faster, meaning 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times, 1,000,000,000 times faster. You know, I want a separation by some orders of magnitude, with some reasonable accounting of resources. If you're using millions and millions of parallel processors, you know, that has to be accounted for and so forth. But we want to beat sort of any currently available classical computer that is running any currently known classical algorithm. Okay, and we have to have that caveat, because computer science is not stage where we know how to prove unconditionally that most of the problems we care about are hard, okay, for classical computers or for quantum computers, right? We just, you know, I mean, all, you know, every time you order something over the internet, right, you're using cryptography. That I hate to break this to you, you know, if you don't already know, but no one has proven it's secure, okay? It's just that, you know, no one has, in a half a century of thinking about it, no one has found fast algorithms to break these types of encryption systems. We can say a little bit more than that. We can say, if you could break this system, then you could do, you know, various other things that would be impressive. But, we don't know how to prove unconditionally that things are hard. So, most problems of practical interest. Okay, so this is going to be a criterion that is relative to the best current knowledge, right? So in particular, this means that it is possible in principle that quantum supremacy could be achieved and then unachieved, right? It could be, you know, achieved, and then someone discovers that there is a much faster classical algorithm after all. And then you'd say that, well, we no longer have quantum supremacy, and then maybe it would be reinstated, you know, later. Okay, so, you know, so keep that in mind. You know, it's not like, you know, landing on the moon that, you know, you do it once and it, you know, stands for all time. Okay, but it's Preskill meant to be talking about sort of a transition era for the world where, you know, the time when quantum computers first start really outperforming classical ones, at least for something. Okay, and so the question is, you know, going to be, you know, are we now entering that era? Okay, so now the problem does not need to be useful. Okay, it can be designed specifically just to show the quantum computer's advantages. That's fine. Think of the Wright brothers' airplane. You know, not a very useful airplane. Think of, you know, Enrico Fermi's nuclear chain reaction, you know, not a very useful, power plant, okay? But, you know, they proved a point, right? And so similarly, the main goal here is sort of to prove a point. And what's important is that the quantum computer has to, so first of all, we would like it to be programmable. Right, so you know you can, you know, this is almost what we mean by a computer, right? That you have a device and you can tell it to do many different things by, you know, sending it control signals, and in particular, you can tell it to solve a problem that has a definition that is independent of the details of your hardware. Okay, so you know that's. You know, a bit of a subtle distinction, but the way I like to think of it is that in order for something to count as a computer, it has to be logically possible for it to output a wrong answer, okay? So, you know, like some people, you know, have objected to quantum supremacy, and they've said, well, why not just take any molecule out in nature that we don't know how to find the ground state of? Why isn't that molecule just, by definition, a quantum computer for the problem of simulating itself? You know, calculating its own ground state, right? And so why isn't quantum supremacy trivial to achieve? Why isn't it everywhere around us? You know, and I would say, well, you know, in those cases, I mean, you know, you might be able to use chemistry as the basis for a quantum supremacy demonstration, but you would want programmability and you would want the separation between the problem being solved and the device that is solving it. Okay, and that is sort of what a programmable chip, like, you know, like what Google has, sort of lets you do. So, okay, and then you know, you could say, what do we mean by a speed up? And this issue becomes especially acute because, you know, there have been claims to use quantum computers to do things faster than classical computers already. If any of you followed the saga of D-Wave, you know, that was exactly about that. Okay, you can often sort of do something faster if you build a special purpose piece of hardware, then it will usually be very, very fast for sort of simulating itself. Right, or for, you know, a problem that is tailored to the thing that you've built. And the trouble is, you know, that it might be very, very fast for that just because of being special purpose hardware and not for reasons of quantum computation, right? Like it might, you know, the speed up that you see might have nothing to do with the quantum computers being a quantum computer. Okay, so I want to rule that out. I want to say that for quantum supremacy, we want to see an actual observed speed up. So you actually are doing something many orders of magnitude faster than anyone knows how to do it with, you know, the biggest supercomputers that are available. You know, even after you've published a description of your challenge and you've opened it up to, you know, a sort of adversarial, you know, research groups and so on, and I would like there to be a problem where quantum computers are theoretically expected to have a scaling advantage, right? Ideally, an exponential speed up, you know, although it doesn't have to be. But, you know, we would like to see that that actually, as you went to larger and larger problems, the advantage of the quantum computer would get larger and larger. And then finally, importantly, I would like the first thing to only be explainable in terms of the second thing. Okay, so, you know, I want no one to be able to explain how the quantum computer did what it did as quickly as it did it without making reference at some point to, well, it had a superposition of, you know, 9 quadrillion basis states. And, you know, if you were trying to simulate it classically, we don't know how to do it except by keeping track of that exponential, you know, profusion of amplitudes, right? We want the speed up to be for that reason and for no other reason. Okay? Okay, so, you know, the one way that I like to think about it is, for me, you know, the number one application of a quantum computer, right, is not, you know, is it breaking cryptography? Is it simulating quantum physics? Is it optimization problems? For me, it is none of those. Okay, it is simply disproving the people who say that scalable quantum computing is impossible. Okay, and you know, there have been you know, many physicists. Well, you know, let's say a subset of physicists and computer scientists who have sort of loudly argued that for, you know, 25 years. You know, I've shown a few, you know, Gil Kalai, Leonid Levin, Bob Laughlin, Michel Diakonov, Robert Alicki. Okay, so, and you know, for me, you know, just to sort of demonstrate that, you know, nature really does provide this quantum computational ability, like, yes, you really can exploit the exponentiality of quantum mechanics to do something faster, and it, you know, it works in the sort of computational complexity regime where we've never sort of directly tested it before. You know, that is at least as interesting to me as to, you know, say, find the Higgs boson or anything like that, okay? And, you know, I hope that eventually we'll also be able to do something useful with quantum computers. That is icing on the cake, okay? You know, I hope that we'll get not only the cake, but also the icing, but, you know. But, you know, I'm harping on this because there have been a lot of people who say we should just dismiss the entire goal of quantum supremacy. It's irrelevant because it doesn't matter for customers and the real world and blah, blah, blah. You know, and, actually a large part of the reason why Google got there first is simply that they were one of the only ones who were trying. Okay, because other people accepted these arguments as sort of as nonsensical as they seem to me. I mean, to me, it seems obvious that before you get the icing, you get the cake, right? Before you try to do something, you know, to beat a classical computer is not a sufficient condition to do anything useful with a quantum computer, and yet it is clearly a necessary condition. Okay, so let's, you know, so why not do that first? Okay, so let me talk about what were the claims made by the group at Google, officially published this past November. So they built a chip called Sycamore, which, you know, it's the size of a normal computer chip like that. And it has on it 53 little loops of wire. Arranged in a, you know, roughly rectangular grid. Why 53? Well, because they built 54 and one of them didn't work. And current can flow around each wire, and, you know, in two different quantum states that you can label as 0 and 1. And then this chip is actually placed in a dilution refrigerator. You know, the size of a closet, maybe, and it's cooled to about a hundredth of a degree above absolute zero, and this causes the loops of wire to superconduct. Okay, and so now our bits behave as qubits, not for a very long time, for a few tens of millionths of a second. Okay, but for that amount of time, they not only do they behave as qubits, but we have very One has very good control over the qubits. Okay, one can send control signals from a classical computer that is outside of the dilution fridge to tell each qubit, like, which of its nearest neighbors it should interact with and how, you know, by which Hamiltonian and when. Okay, so one can program in a sequence of operations. What one can do about 20 layers of gates, okay, about like a quantum circuit of depth about 20, and then still be able to extract some signal at the end of it. So the qubits will still have a little bit of coherence left. Okay, so.
It's the coherence that sets the lifetime?
Basically, yeah. Yeah. You know, the qubits have a relaxation time. I mean, there's a bunch of different sources of error. There's also a lot of error introduced by the measurement of the qubits, right? And that's also a big factor. There's also a lot of time that you have to spend calibrating the qubits before you even run any circuit on them at all, right? But so all of these are issues right now. But okay, now what is done with the circuit is going to be to solve some sampling problem, and we're going to come back to why a sampling problem, and what do we mean by that, and why is that a good idea? But basically, we're going to do some sequence of operations, which, you know, in this case is a more or less randomly chosen sequence of operations. Okay, but it's randomly chosen, and then it's fixed. So you can do the same random sequence of operations over and over again to qubits that are always just reinitialized back to the all zero state, right? You just keep doing the same circuit over and over. And then each time you measure, you measure each qubit, you see either a zero or a one. And you know, there are correlations between the qubits. So really, each time you measure, you're seeing a sample from a probability distribution over the set of 53-bit strings. Okay? Now, if this distribution were uniform, every string were equally likely, this would not be very interesting. You might as well flip a coin 53 times and save the hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, that it took to build this device. But it is not a uniform distribution. We'll see, you know, it has little non-uniformities in it, and those are really the things that we are looking for. As sort of the signatures of the quantum behavior of the device. Okay, so we want to be sampling from some probability distribution over 53-bit strings that I'll call D. Because of the noise in the system, what we actually sample from, in the case of Google's experiment, is a distribution that is about 0.998 times the uniform distribution plus 0.002 times the distribution D that we want. Okay, now that sounds bad, right? That sounds like, you know, a little bit of signal and a lot of noise. Okay, but what that means is simply, if I want to extract the signal from this noise, well, like if the amount of signal is epsilon, then the number of repetitions that it will take to extract that signal scales like 1 over epsilon squared. Okay, so in this case, that means hundreds of thousands or even millions of repetitions. Now, the good news is that taking each sample with the Google chip, you know, takes, as I said, you know, maybe 40 microseconds or something like that. So after a few minutes, you really can take millions of samples, okay, which is enough to extract the signal. Okay, right? And then Google in its paper had an argument that, well, if you took the best algorithms that they knew about, which were actually ones that came from a 2017 paper by me and my student, Luigi Chen, and you ran I'll come back to the algorithm, but you know, if you ran that algorithm on at least the fastest supercomputer that was easily available to Google, which was one that had about 1 million cores, then to simulate what this chip had done, you know, in solving the sampling problem would take about 10,000 years. Okay, that was their estimate, and then you know that got and you know maybe more meaningful is to look at you know the number of elementary operations, you know, and if we count you know what all the cores are doing, I get you know that's like a factor of 10 to the 15 or so, you know, separation in number of elementary operations, although it's a little vague how you define that. Okay, now we, you know, we'll come back to this 10,000 years thing. Okay, don't take that number too seriously. Okay, okay, but I'm a complexity theorist, so you know my interest has always been less in specific numbers than in the scaling behavior. Okay, so what can we say about scaling behavior? You know, and why? Why do this sampling problem, right? You know, you might say, well, wait, you know, we were promised that quantum computers would factor huge numbers, right? Why not do factoring? Why not do something of, you know, of more real world significance? Okay, so, well, you know, indeed, 26 years ago, Peter Shor discovered that if you built a full fault-tolerant, you know, error-corrected, scalable quantum computer, you could use it to factor an n-digit number in something like n squared steps. Okay, and you know most of the cryptography that we use today is based on the belief that factoring and a few other problems like it are hard. So you know, if you could demonstrate, and factoring even has an additional advantage, which is that you can easily generate some huge prime numbers. And then, you know, for yourself, and then check that they're prime, multiply them, give the composite number to the quantum computer, and then you can check for yourself whether it produced the right factors, right? The checking part is easy, right? So you could say, you know, that would really be like a gold standard demonstration of quantum supremacy if you could really do it. Unfortunately, you can't do it with today's technology. It seems to require error correction, which would mean you might need hundreds or thousands of physical qubits for every logical qubit that you wanted to you know have in an encoded form. Okay, so when you need thousands of logical qubits to run Shor's algorithm to factor a number, then at that point you're talking millions of physical qubits. Okay, nobody is close to that. You know, we hope to eventually get there. And similarly for Grover's search algorithm, right? I mean, that's not an exponential speed up, but that also mostly becomes relevant in the era of error correction. And so, so around a decade ago, a bunch of us, you know, started thinking about, well, you know, what would just be the easiest way to get a quantum computer to do something that was classically hard? Okay, if we just completely gave up on, you know, the task being useful for anything. Okay, and we just said we want to be as confident as possible that we're doing something hard, and we want to do something hard as soon as possible. Okay, and once you start, so you know we were studying what became known as quantum supremacy, although that term had not been coined yet, and one thing that we quickly realized was that once you ask the question that way, then there are enormous advantages to switching attention from problems with a single right answer, like factoring, and so forth, to sampling problems. There's problems where the goal is to output a sample for exactly or approximately from some target probability distribution. Okay, so problems, you know, where, you know, there are going to be many possible valid outputs, and the test for whether you're doing the computation correctly or not is going to be something statistical. Okay, so as far as I know, this idea was actually first raised in a paper by Terhal and DiVincenzo in 2004 that was far ahead of its time. And then sort of the modern interest in sampling-based quantum supremacy experiments sort of started with two papers. One was by me and Alex Arkhipov and was about something called boson sampling, okay, which was like a way to solve these sorts of hard sampling problems using quantum optics in that case. And the other one was called commuting Hamiltonians. And that was proposed independently of us by Bremner, Joza, and Shepard. And what we did in these papers is that we showed that there are probability distributions that a quantum computer could sample, and not even a universal quantum computer. It could be an even much more rudimentary thing than that, right? Like a very, very bare bones type of, you know, piece of quantum computing hardware could sample distributions such that, you know, and we could prove this, that if a classical computer could efficiently sample from those same distributions, then the polynomial hierarchy would collapse. Now, if you don't know what that means, you could take my word for it that it's bad. But, you know, it is basically, you know, so you've heard of like P equals NP, you know, and that being a very unlikely thing to have happen. The polynomial hierarchy collapsing is almost as bad as P equaling NP. You know, almost as good, depending on your point of view. Okay, but it would be a staggering collapse of the universe of complexity theory, and you know, and that's, you know, and you could say in the present state of theoretical computer science, that is about as strong of evidence as you ever get that, you know, a problem is hard. Right, and one could say that you know, these distributions that, you know, quantum experiments can sample cannot be efficiently sampled classically, assuming that the polynomial hierarchy does not collapse. Okay, and that's all. Now, we knew that was not the, you know, yet the sort of the physically most meaningful question, because after all, we ought to worry about, well, what about an experiment that only approximately sampled these distributions, right? In real life, that's the best we could ever hope for. You know, would that have this staggering consequence? So we spent a long time studying that question. Arkhipov and I did. We got some results that were not quite as satisfying. Okay, they don't, you know, they're not quite based on the polynomial hierarchy not collapsing. But, you know, by the way, that is one of the main, that remains one of the main theoretical open problems in that area, you know, whether one can show that. But, you know, at any rate, you know, if you're willing to stick your neck out a little bit further, you know, certainly these things look plausibly hard. Okay, and you know, and we were sort of led into this just from thinking purely about computer science, and, you know, about interesting hard problems that we could encode into the amplitudes of a quantum computation. But then what happened was we started talking to experimentalists, and, you know, they got all excited because they were like, these bosons that you're talking about, you know, they actually exist. You know, we actually have some in our lab, you know, and we actually do photonics experiments, and we could try to demonstrate this, not with 50 photons yet, like you're asking for, but with 5 or 6 photons. And so they did that. So, you know, already in like 2012, 2013, we started actually doing theory that was directly connected to what experimentalists were doing. And, you know, and they would come back to us and say, well, what you're asking for, you know, we just do not have single photon sources that are good enough to do that, but we have these other kinds of photon sources. Now, can you solve one of your hard polynomial hierarchy, whatever, with that kind of photon source? And we would say, well, we don't know. We have to think about that. And so, you know, so there was a real, you know, two-way interaction. Okay, so to summarize, the advantages of sampling problems, first of all, you know, a lot of these things look just experimentally way, way closer to realization in the near term than, let's say, running Shor's algorithm on a full, you know, fault-tolerant quantum computer. And secondly, if all you want is confidence that your problem is classically hard, then, you know, we can arguably be more confident that a lot of these things are classically hard than we are that factoring is classically hard, for example. Okay, well, disadvantages. Well, we don't know what it's good. We didn't know what it was good for. And we also didn't know how to, with a classical computer, how to easily check the results. Okay, so there's a big irony here that, you can do this computation quickly with your quantum computer that classically we think would take like 2^n time. But as far as we know, checking the results with a classical computer also takes like 2^n time. Okay, so what does that mean? It means you can do the experiment with, let's say, n equals 50 qubits, right? And you can just barely check check the results with a big enough supercomputer. But there would be no point in doing these experiments with 100 qubits, because even if the experiment works, you'll never be able to prove it. So, so these are very much designed for sort of proving quantum supremacy in the near term, of course, eventually you want true scalability, and for that you're probably going to need error correction. We are trying to do what we can in the era before that. Okay, so now I can tell you what is the specific proposal that that Google ended up doing, I actually started an email thread with them in 2015 about what would be the easiest route to sort of demonstrating quantum supremacy with devices like, we knew at that time they were planning to build with, 50 or 60 or 70 coupled superconducting qubits. And so, there was an option that you could use those qubits to control microwave photons and resonators and then do boson sampling. You could do the commuting Hamiltonians proposal of Bremner, Joza, and Shepard. But what sort of emerged from our discussions with them is that what probably made the most sense was for them to just do something that looked as hard as they could with the hardware that they were building. Okay, and just do something that was sort of native to their superconducting architecture. And then, they would leave it to us, the theorists, to sort of figure out what it means, okay? Or sort of to adapt the theory that, we had had to that setting. Okay, so here's the picture to have in mind. Okay, so we have our, 50 or 60 qubit quantum computer. Now it's gonna be challenged by some classical skeptic who sends it a challenge circuit, call it C, which was, let's say, randomly generated. Okay, a circuit is just a sequence of interactions. So it's just a collection of gates acting on one or two qubits at a time. Okay, and you can do many gates in parallel. So like all of these different gates here can all be done in parallel. Okay, the gates are nearest neighbor only, so they can, interact each qubit with its horizontal or vertical nearest neighbors. And you can control the exact form of the coupling. Okay, so you have some control over which two qubit Hamiltonian is being applied. And so then, the circuit, whatever it is, gives rise to an ideal probability distribution, over n bit strings. We'll call that D sub C, C being the circuit. And the skeptic is going to ask the quantum computer to just quickly send back a bunch of independent samples from that distribution. Okay, so so let's say k independent samples, S1 up to sk. And again, in the case of Google's experiment, k is actually a few million. Okay, but certainly not nearly enough samples that you could characterize the whole distribution, right? The distribution has like a support of size 2^53. So you're only seeing a very, very tiny fraction of that. The circuit looks like I can stagger different types of layers of gates, like in this little picture, right? In order that after enough of these layers have been applied, every qubit has been able to influence every other qubit. Okay. And then we get these samples, S1 up to SK. Now we've got to apply some statistical test to them. okay? And the test that Google ended up using is something that they call the linear cross entropy benchmark, linear XEB. And it's actually a really, really simple test. All they do is using their classical computer and a lot of brute force, okay, they calculate the predicted probability of outputting each of the samples that was observed. Okay, that's what this matrix element is, right? So there's this, the, you know, the probability that that ideal circuit C would have output the string S sub I, right? The absolute square of the amplitude, okay? You just calculate that, which takes, let's say, 2 to the n time, for each sample S sub I, and then we add them all up, and then we see, does the sum exceed a threshold or not, okay? And now the question is, well, what should be that threshold? Okay, well, let's think about this. Suppose I were to just pick the samples S1, S2, and so forth, uniformly at random. Okay, then what value would I expect for this sum? Well, I would expect each of these numbers to be about 2 to the minus n on average, right? Because, you know, it's a distribution over 2 to the n different strings. Okay, and so I'd expect their sum to be about k over 2 to the n. Okay, so in other words, this constant b, you know, if I just pick the strings randomly, I would expect b to be about 1. Okay, so think about this as like a complexity version of the Bell inequality, right? And then we're saying that the classical value is 1. Okay, what about the quantum value? Well, if I were actually sampling from d sub c, from c's output distribution, then I'm going to be more likely to see strings that have higher probabilities. Right, and so this sum should, all else equal, it should be larger. You know, how much larger? Well, that's a calculation that one has to do. Okay, but the core of it is that, you know, if I take the state that, you know, a small random quantum circuit produces, it is not a hard random state. It can't be because it doesn't have nearly enough degrees of freedom in it. But for most purposes, it behaves as if it were hard random. Okay, which means, you know, it just looks like a random quantum state, looks like a big mess, big piece of garbage, okay? And, you know, and what does a random quantum state look like? Well, each amplitude looks like an independent normal random variable, right? In fact, an independent complex normal random variable, okay? And so, you know, they fluctuate. Some amplitudes are a little bit bigger, some are a little bit smaller, okay? And if you take the absolute square of a complex Gaussian, you actually get a precisely an exponentially distributed random variable, you know, which is a beautiful mathematical fact. Okay, but using that, one can show that if you had a noiseless quantum computer and you did this experiment, you would expect to saturate this inequality with b equals 2. Okay, so you get the quantum value is twice the classical value. Okay, so, you know, long story short, in its experiment, Google was able to get B equals about 1.002. Okay, so, you know, nowhere near 2, but on the other hand, bigger than 1. Okay, and, you know, and they were able to take enough data to actually statistically show that they are bounded above 1. Okay, so that's what all of this is based on. Okay, so again, you know, all the 2 to the n possible output strings are exponentially unlikely. You know, you'll probably never see the same output twice in, you know, when you, you know, however long you run this experiment. But the key is that some strings are unlikelier than others. You know, like twice or 3 times as unlikely as others. And so the thing that we are checking for is, are the outputs preferentially concentrated among the ones that are predicted to be a little bit likelier? Okay. John Martinez, who is the head of the Google group, likes to use the analogy of speckle. So like if I took a laser pointer and I just sent the light through some ground glass, I would get some pattern like this one, where, you know, in some places there was constructive interference, where, you know, the different amplitudes of the different paths that the photon could take have reinforced a little bit more. And then in the darker spots, there was more destructive interference, where, you know, the different contributions canceled out more. Okay, the same happens in the quantum supremacy experiment, except think of it as being a speckle pattern, like of size 2^n, right? So of size 9 quadrillion in the case of Google's experiment. Okay, where, you know, for each of the outputs, right, it's, the distribution mostly looks like garbage, but we care about the pattern of this specific garbage, right? Because, you know, some strings suffered a little bit more destructive interference. Other strings enjoyed a little bit more constructive interference in their amplitudes. And if we do statistics on the outputs that we see, then we can detect that. Okay, so... So I said that, you know, this is the experiment that Google did. As I said, they measured, you know, at least with the hardest circuits that they were able to verify classically, they saw that, you know, they are seeing a signal, you know, fidelity 1/500, you know, which would mean like B equals 1.002. You know, this was the signature of quantum supremacy that they were looking for. And then they published the best classical simulation time that they knew. I should say, for their very hardest circuits, they actually did not even have the computer power to verify the results. And so they were, you know, they made some extrapolations from the easier cases. But, you know, I was just more interested in what were the hardest cases that they had directly verified. Okay. Then a few weeks later, so, you know, even before Google's paper was officially published, IBM published a rebuttal paper. Okay, so IBM, you know, is Google's main competitor right now in superconducting qubits. Okay, and so they initially responded to Google's thing by saying, well, we don't view quantum supremacy as even being a legitimate goal. It's, you know, pointless. It's, you know, we don't care about this, blah, blah, blah. But then a few weeks later, I guess they realized that that response was not fully satisfactory. And so they came out with a second response, which is, well, we don't think Google achieved it anyway. So basically what their response paper said is that if you used Summit at Oak Ridge National Labs, which is the largest supercomputer that currently exists on Earth, okay, and which IBM knows a lot about because they installed it last year, okay, this thing fills the area of 2 basketball courts. It's got about 100,000 cores. More importantly, for our purposes, it's got 250 petabytes of hard disk. Okay? They said, well, that's actually enough hard disk that you could just take your whole state vector, 2^53 amplitudes, and just write it explicitly to hard disk. Okay, and once you had done that, you know, if you could commandeer this, you know, entire machine, then we think that we could simulate the Google chip in about 2.5 days. You know, which indeed is a lot better than 10,000 years. Okay, and you know, now they said, you know, they didn't actually do it, because you know it's not so easy to get time on the world's largest supercomputer. It's, you know, used for some nuclear weapon, something or other. You can't just say, you know, we have this, you know, move over. We have quantum supremacy to do. But you know, look, let's accept that, you know, that this would work. Something like this could be done. Seems totally plausible. You know, it is embarrassing on Google's part that they overlooked this. You know, that, I mean, you know, basically, you know, like I was looking at it and I was thinking, like, I love that they're using our algorithm, but is it really the best thing? Like, you know, is 2^53 memory really out of the question? I said, well, look, you know, these are constant factors. You know, if anyone on Earth knows constant factors, it's Google. Certainly not a complexity theorist like me. Okay, it was overlooked that there is, you know, currently one supercomputer that has the hard disk space to do this. Okay, and then it's really like a fairly naive Schrodinger simulation, meaning just, you know, you just run the Schrodinger equation on this gigantic wave function that you've now stored in hard disk. It's roughly that simple. And you know, now the point I want to make is that, you know, as long as this is sort of the strongest response to the Google experiment, well, then, you know, you could say, well, you know, it's a little bit like the Kasparov versus Deep Blue chess match, right? Except with the enormous irony that IBM is now in the role of Kasparov, okay? It's like, in other words, you know, with a heroic effort, you could just barely, you know, simulate what the quantum computer is doing, you know, with the biggest supercomputer literally on the planet, okay? If they had had 55 qubits instead of 53, this already wouldn't have worked, okay? And, you know, so like it's clear that within a year or two, the quantum computer wins, as long as this is the best kind of simulation that's possible. Okay, but this brings us to a deeper question, which is this the best classical simulation that's possible? Couldn't there be something much better? You know, and how do we know there isn't? Okay, so the real question is sort of, is there a complexity theoretic barrier to sort of quickly simulating, you know, a random circuit sampling experiment like the one that Google did using a classical computer? And we have to be careful because, you know, all we really know is that, you know, Google's chip generates results that pass this linear cross entropy benchmark. Right, and so we have to consider classical algorithms that might only do the same thing, right? They might just be completely specialized to spoofing this benchmark and do nothing else. And so we have to study how hard is that problem. Okay, so now this is exactly the sort of question that, you know, a lot of us had asked in quantum complexity theory in the decade or so before Google did this experiment. And so, you know, we realized that there are, you know, there's a whole range of different classical simulation algorithms that have different profiles of running time, you know, different trade-offs between time and memory usage. Like the naive Schrodinger simulation is the fastest, but it also is extremely memory intensive, right? Needs 2^n time, also 2^n memory. A completely different way of classically simulating a quantum circuit would be what I'd call the Feynman simulation, where you just calculate an amplitude that you care about as a sum of exponentially many contributions, right? As a sum over histories, okay? And that uses only linear memory. You can keep reusing the same memory for each term in the sum, but the time grows exponentially with the number of gates in your circuit. Okay, and think of, you know, the number of qubits is 53, but the number of gates is like 1,000. Okay, and not even Google can do 2^1,000. Okay, it exceeds a Google. what we had done a couple years ago is Li-Ji Chen and I we discovered how you could actually sort of interpolate between the Schrodinger and the Feynman methods and do something with linear memory and not quite 2^n time, but getting down closer to there, like the depth of the circuit to the n power. This is a recursive divide and conquer algorithm, and this is actually now used in a lot of the state of the art classical simulations of quantum circuits. Okay, but again, how do we know that you just couldn't do much better than this? Okay, well, so we do have some theoretical hardness evidence. You know, it is less satisfying than we would like. But, you know, as computer scientists, we try to do at least a little bit better than saying, you know, I don't know, seems hard to us, you know. So Li-Ji Chen and I had a sort of hardness theorem for spoofing a benchmark that was not exactly the one that Google used. And then recently, Sam Gunn, who is an undergrad at UT, and I sort of adapted our analysis to the specific benchmark that Google was using. Okay, and basically what our result says is that, well, suppose that you had a classical algorithm to spoof Google's linear cross entropy benchmark, and suppose it was fast, like it ran in much less than 2^n time. Then there would also be a fast classical algorithm that could take a specific output amplitude in your quantum circuit. Like let's say, you know, the probability of outputting the all zero string or something like that, and it would estimate it with variance at least slightly better than the trivial estimator that would always just estimate 2^-n. Okay? So, you know, and by better I mean like 8 to the minus n better. So, you know, really slightly better, but, you know, it seems kind of unlikely, right? And so what we're saying is there's nothing specific about spoofing this benchmark that, in the sense that if you could do that, then you could also just estimate specific amplitudes of interest to you a little bit better than chance, given a random quantum circuit, you know, which seems like a powerful ability to have. You know, the proof is super simple. It involves just, it's a reduction. You know, it involves first hiding the output that you really care about. So if it's the all zero string, you sort of make it some random other string. And then you run your assumed spoofing algorithm and you see whether it ever outputs that string that you care about. And if it does, then you guess that that string had maybe a slightly higher probability. And if it doesn't output it, then you guess that it had maybe a slightly smaller probability. And, you know, and that's a really crappy estimation algorithm, but it does a little bit better than the trivial estimator, and that's good enough. Okay, so so the final thing that I wanted to mention in this talk is that, you know, the obvious objection that you could raise to these sampling-based supremacy experiments is, well, even if they work, they're just giving you a bunch of random bits as output, which seems obviously completely useless, right? It's, you know, this is like the epitome of uselessness. Here are some random bits if you don't know what they look like. And what changed, something changed a couple years ago, which is that some of us realized, well, random bits are not completely useless, or certainly not if you can prove that they're random. Okay, so what I realized a couple of years ago was that as soon as an experiment like Google's could be gotten to work, you almost immediately you could repurpose it to get a protocol for generating a large number of random bits, you know, which again by itself not that impressive, but then proving to a skeptic that you must have generated them randomly, at least under some plausible assumptions. Okay, and I've basically already described to you how this is done, right? It's basically just you give the quantum computer challenge circuits. Let's say a skeptic does. You know, the skeptic generates these challenge circuits using a little bit of entropy. So it has, you know, the classical challenger will have a small random seed to start with. It will use its seed to pseudo-randomly generate challenge circuits. Each circuit, it will send over to the quantum computer, which, yeah, Google image search, that's apparently what they look like. And it will demand back from the quantum computer a response, you know, some samples from that circuit's output distribution within a very short time, like let's say half a second, okay, to allow for internet latency. Okay, and then get back the response. The classical computer generates a new circuit, sends it to the quantum computer, demands back new samples, gets them back, and so forth. Okay, and then much later at its leisure, the classical computer can run the linear cross-entropy benchmark to check, did these samples really come from a quantum computer, right? But now if the test passes, now here's the key new point, okay? So, you know, we're verifying that these samples actually came from a quantum computer, you know, could not have been quickly generated by a classical computer, right? That's cool. But we're as a byproduct, we are verifying something more than that, I claim. We're verifying under plausible assumptions, even a quantum computer, the only way that it could have quickly generated these samples that pass this linear cross-entropy benchmark is by actually sampling them from an output distribution that has a lot of entropy. Okay? One can justify that statement, you know, using some further complexity assumptions, but, you know, intuitively, right, I hope it's at least plausible, right? You know, if you wanted to secretly bias, like you could try to search for the string with the largest probability, you know, among all of them, that would be deterministic. But even a quantum computer would take an immense amount of time to do that, you know, we think, right? What a quantum computer can do quickly that will pass the linear cross-entropy test is to sample the strings randomly. But in that case, it is giving you a lot of real entropy. You know, not just pseudo-randomness, but real randomness. And you can then feed that into what's called a seeded randomness extractor. And from that, you could extract nearly uniform random bits, which you could then use for cryptographic applications. Okay, so yeah. So that's the idea. Now, obviously, there are much, much easier ways than this to generate random bits, which are used all the time. You can go to websites like random.org, you know, that will give you as many allegedly random bits as you want. And these are fine if you trust your random number generator, if you own it. But, you know, for modern applications, so for example, for what's called proof of stake cryptocurrencies, which are, you know, cryptocurrencies that try to be like Bitcoin, but without using 1% of the world's energy to invert a hash function. Okay, well, you know, to get that environmental friendliness, you need a huge source of random bits. Right, that everybody trusts to be random, okay, and that are used basically to run a lottery to decide who gets to add the next block to the blockchain. Okay, so this could be used for applications like that, where you need a large source of random bits that everybody trusts. So, you know, Google and NIST are actually working right now to demonstrate a randomness beacon based on my protocol. This is not the most impressive application of a quantum computer you've ever seen, but it might be the only application that is realizable using, you know, the device that Google has right now. So that's why people were interested. Okay, so there's lots of exciting places to go next. Replicate Google's result in other hardware platforms with higher fidelity, more qubits, independent challenges, and independent verification. Design new classical simulation algorithms. As I should mention that there was a recent breakthrough by Fernando Brandao, Aram Harrow, and others, which does not refute the Google result because it only applies to circuits of very low depth. But it looks like for low-depth circuits, there actually are better classical simulations that can be done. So that should be, you know, there's a lot to explore. We should push that as far as it can go. And the other direction, get better complexity theoretic evidence for hardness. Then can we get quantum supremacy with a near-term device and where the classical verification can be done efficiently? You know, we know how to do that, but for full fault-tolerant quantum computers, can we do that in the near term? And can we improve my randomness scheme to, for example, get more and more random bits by running the same circuit over and over? Okay, so just to conclude, Google has apparently achieved quantum computational supremacy using random circuit sampling on 53 qubits, building on a lot of the useless complexity theory that we did over the last decade. Even if true, this leaves the enormous challenges of getting to scalability and fault tolerance, right? There is no error correction in Google's current device. Okay, and that huge challenge remains for the future. And yet this is already enough, I think, to refute those who said that quantum speedups would never be possible, or, you know, certainly to put the ball firmly in their court. It was thought obvious for years that these sampling-based quantum supremacy experiments have no applications. My certified randomness protocol might change that, but many challenges remain in making it practical. All right, so thanks for listening.
So we'd like to start with questions from students. So there are students that have questions.
How much hope is there for a near-term algorithm that we can classically verify?
It's a wonderful question. I think that the best shot that we're likely to have will be some kind of interesting quantum simulation, some simulation of a condensed matter system, a material, where actually the verification in that case might be just comparing against the actual material itself, right? Comparing against nature rather than, you know, doing a calculation with your classical computer, right? But at least we would have some independent, at least theoretically fast means of verification. And then there are other things people are exploring. There was a proposal due to Bremner and Shepard that I thought was really beautiful, and I kept saying that people should spend more effort in investigating the security of their protocol. And then just like a month ago, while I was giving a talk saying that, someone posted a paper on the archive breaking that protocol.
Okay,
Okay, so I think that certainly now the field is open for someone to design some other protocol like that one, you know, that will have efficient classical verification and that can be done in the near term era. I think that this has risen to be like one of the most important open problems in the whole field.
Or student questions.
Can you quickly highlight the point that you were making why quantum chemistry experiments don't quite fit, or you're not very convinced with them?
Because when we say that we have a computer, right? What do we mean, right? I think, you know, we mean we have a device that you can program to do something, to answer some question, you know, where the question can be defined independently from the computer. Okay, so hopefully it does more than one thing, right? Maybe it's not a Turing universal computer, but you know, at least it can do multiple things that you program it to do, right? And the things that it does, you know, should be, you know, like for example, if I ask a computer, is 17 prime, right? Then I don't need to know the internal workings of the computer to know did it output the right answer or not. Right, you know, there is an independent standard against which I can judge the answer. Okay, and now this random circuit sampling experiment, whatever else you may think about it, right, it satisfies this criterion. Right, there is this linear cross entropy benchmark. You know, the experiment succeeds if you get a high score on this benchmark, bounded above one. The experiment does not succeed if you don't do that. Right? And in order to make that determination, I don't need to know anything about the details of the noise in Google's device. Right? You know, notice that like I did not, you know, in talking about did the experiment succeed, I never talked about the noise in the device or any detailed knowledge of the physics of the device. You should have been worried if I had. Right, because the criterion for did the device succeed has to be independent. Someone, a skeptic from the outside, has to be able to make the determination. Okay, and that is what sort of some random molecule that you find in nature doesn't, you know, you could say like by definition it always succeeds at simulating itself perfectly, right? And you know, so you could, you could try to, you know. Making it more like a computer by, you know, coaxing the molecule to do a variety of different tasks, you know, where those tasks have some clear mathematical definition involving some Hamiltonian, let's say, that you could write down. And then, you know, you would be using the molecule as a means of calculating something else. And, you know, if you had done that, then I would say at that point, maybe this molecule, you know, should count as a computer. Right, but if it's just you can't calculate the ground state of this system, therefore quantum supremacy, I think that just does not cut it. Yeah.
More student questions? Okay, so the question is for everybody, which also includes students.
I guess a follow-up to that,
sure.
Is our understanding of the difference between a trivial and a non-trivial problem.
Yeah.
If we take like the three-body problem,
uh-huh.
in gravitational or magnetic physics,
mm-hmm.
We could design a computer which would just have three bodies of varying masses,
mm-hmm.
and we could specify the initial trajectories, and it would record
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
So we could say, okay, we're going to do three-body problems where the mass ratios are integer ratios,
mm-hmm.
but otherwise unspecified mass.
Mm-hmm.
up to a ratio like 10 to 1,
mm-hmm.
any of relative velocities, any coordinate
mm-hmm.
system. And I can build a physical device which
mm-hmm.
will calculate the trajectories for all those things with enough sort of balls available. And
that's
a problem that's really hard to classically solve, but there's nothing.
Yeah, well, so I think that that actually it's not going to work. And the reason why it's not going to work is chaos. Okay, you're going to have enormous chaotic sensitivity to initial conditions. And you know, I want to really, really clearly distinguish things that are hard to simulate because of chaos, like the weather, like a three-body problem. Okay, and I would say that this is not sort of a computational issue. This is simply an issue that you do not know the initial state or cannot control the initial state to the requisite precision. right? And I want to distinguish that from this, you know, the issue that we care about, which is, you know, that you you don't have chaos, right? You know your initial state perfectly well enough, and the only reason why you cannot feasibly simulate your system with a digital computer is the exponentiality of the quantum mechanical wave function. Right. And so, in fact, I was very careful in my definition of quantum supremacy to try to separate out that issue, which is the only issue that I care about here, from all of the other reasons why a physical system might be hard to simulate, including, you know, chaos, including lack of knowledge of the initial conditions. That is not what I'm concerned with here.
More questions?
Yeah.
Do you see any merit at all in IBM's rebuttal of the Google? The largest computer in the world, still taking 1,000 times as long with.
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, they're pointing out that you can do this. You know, obviously it was something that Google had missed. And they should have, you know, that is sort of exactly how people should respond, right? You know, I think that sort of quibbling over, splitting hairs over the definition of quantum supremacy is actually much less interesting to me, right? Like, I don't, you know, if you don't like the words, then just make up other words, right? It's just, I don't care that much about the definitions. What I care about is, you know, are you actually doing something that is hard for a classical computer or not? You know, for reasons of quantum computational complexity. Okay, that's what I care about, and of course, to show that you can simulate, to show that you can classically simulate the device faster than had been known, you know, how to do it. That is exactly on point, you know, and that's exactly what people should be doing. So I'm glad that IBM, you know, did the work to sort of figure out, you know, how you would use Summit to simulate the device. By the way, Google's response to that was, you know, was well, you know, one, you know, you implement it and test it, and then we'll discuss it. But you know, which I think was actually a little bit weak. You know, it would have been, you know, much better to say, well, you know, look, you know, probably this would work, and you know, and oops, you know, but you know, wait for our, you know, our next chip, right? I mean, once they're at, you know, 57 qubits, 60 qubits, then you know, you need, you know, let's say, you know, like a whole small city full of Summits, right? If you were at, you know, 80 qubits, 90 qubits, then maybe you'd have to fill the whole world with Summits, right? You know, and so it's clear that as long as the best response is still facing this 2 to the n bottleneck, then, you know, we have clearly entered the era where, for random circuit sampling, at least, you know, quantum computers win. And that is an exciting thing. And that's, you know, it doesn't matter how you spin it or what words you use to describe it. That's a big deal. What would really substantively refute it would be if someone could say, well, actually, random quantum circuits are much easier than you thought. And here's a polynomial time classical algorithm to simulate them, right? No one has said that, okay? What?
Must be two things going on here. Part of what IBM are saying is just our computer's even bigger and faster than you thought it was.
Yeah.
Going to be faster.
Well, yeah. It
does some clever coding thing as well.
Yeah, there
is a bigger computer part of the argument, doesn't
there's a little bit of clever encoding to get this to actually fit on the, you know, on the machine and actually work, and you know, and to be parallelized efficiently, right? But I think the main thing was just that, you know, Google had had a mindset of, you know, of course, you know, you don't want to write the hard disk, right? That's unbelievably slow. Once you have to write the hard disk, you're toast. But you know, for something of this at this scale, the blow up in time when you try to save on memory is so large that, you know, it actually would make sense to write it to hard disk. And furthermore, that there is a supercomputer that has the requisite hard disk space, you know, and probably, you know, with, you know, again, you know, I, this is like an initial, I think this is not at all the end of the story, even just narrowly of sampling-based quantum supremacy, right? I very much hope that in short order, we're going to see experiments with 60 qubits and so forth, and with better fidelity. And so even the loopholes that people are quibbling about right now, you know, within another year or two, that those will no longer be relevant. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Hey.
This is probably the kind of question you're going to say, how come I didn't ask you this 15 years ago? But it just shows my ignorance. There are tests you can do that you tell us about, like a Bell test, to tell us that quantum physics is necessary for some phenomenon, or entanglement or something like that.
Sure.
You didn't mention those. And then you mentioned speed up tests. Is there any, are there relations between them? If there is a speed up of a certain amount, must there be something which satisfies a Bell test or uses entanglement in some way?
Oh, So certainly, like, when you see the speed up from, you know, a quantum computation like the one we're talking about, no one has any way to explain that without, you know, that I know of, without making reference to very, very entangled states on 53 qubits, right? Now, you know, I don't know, like, a proof in the sense that, you know, well, you know, it could be just some magic computation gremlin inside of the Google device, right? And, you know, and you know, and because we don't, you know, we don't have like an Alice and Bob who are spatially separated across a large distance here, you know, there's just the one quantum computer. So it's not, you know, it might be hard to make a clean statement about entanglement, right? I mean, you know, the entanglement that we, you know, almost certainly is there is entanglement just within the chip, you know, within the qubits on this chip. You know, one, by the way, one can do Bell tests directly, and they have done that, you know, in GHZ tests and so forth. So you can directly verify the presence of entanglement on the chip, and, you know, and they routinely do that. Okay. Now, from a broader perspective, I mean, I view, you know, these like linear cross entropy, you know, this random quantum circuit sampling benchmark as like precisely the computational analog of the Bell test. Right, so I, you know, was making this analogy, right, that basically you are trying to just, you know, achieve a certain number, you know, in your, you know, in the statistics of your experiment, in order to, you know, solely for the purpose of ruling out that you, you know, you any classical explanation, you know, of a certain kind for your experiment.
But the question I ask is, does your speed up test imply that there is some Bell test that would show entanglement?
All right. Well, I'll be happy to talk about that offline. But I mean, I think for you know, in practice, the only way you get a quantum speed up is if you have entanglement and if you were also able to pass Bell tests. So in practice, I think that is certainly true. But to actually prove a theorem along the lines that you're asking for might be a more subtle affair, where we would have to carefully spell out the assumptions. So I'd be happy to talk about that offline if you wanted. Yeah.
Google a few years ago claimed that they had 72 qubits.
Yeah.
But they didn't use that 72 qubits.
That's right. That's right.
Got rid of the IBM.
That's right. That's right. So yeah, they're you know, maybe they're wishing that they didn't. Yeah. So first they built. So by the way, you know, like those of us who followed this, we knew that Google was working on this. You know, they said, okay, yeah, by 2017, no problem, you know, maybe 2018, very, very, very latest, you know, this is going to be done. You know, so I've learned actually to, you know, in interdisciplinary subject, I've learned the experimentalist language a little bit, you know, and, you know, I've learned what kind of multipliers to, you know, attach to any time estimates that, you know, that I'm given, you know, which are not infinity, right? I don't multiply the times by infinity, okay? But what happened was that they first fabricated a 72-qubit chip called bristle cone. And what they found was that the crosstalk between the qubits was too high. It was, you know, each qubit was interfering with its neighbors too much. And so then they decided to try a more complicated design that was for, you know, that would greatly reduce the crosstalk. And because it was more complicated to build, they initially scaled back to 54, which then became 53. And, you know, and they made a lot of design decisions solely for the purpose of demonstrating quantum supremacy as quickly as possible, right? Like, they have a 2-qubit gate on the chip that, you know, is not like a kind of 2-qubit gate you would ever want in any practical circuit, right? But it's just there to evade certain kinds of efficient classical simulations based on tensor networks, right? It's just there to make the thing hard to simulate. Okay, so, you know, so they were very concentrated on, you know, and, you know, but I think it's you know, just like with the Bell inequality, right? The first experiments that violated the Bell inequality were kind of marginal, right? And, you know, and because, you know, they're like staggering over the finish line, right? And then over the, you know, the ensuing years, you got better and better experiments.
Once went the other way.
Huh? Well, yeah, that may have also been the case here. It's just that, you know, they weren't published and we weren't all discussing it like we are with this one, right? So I mean, you know, the evidence, let's say, for the reality of Bell inequality violation became stronger and stronger over the years, and more loopholes got closed. And, you know, I expect that there will be a similar development here.
So it's a similar question.
Oh, okay.
I was hoping to get a sense of what the challenge is to go from 54 to 60.
Hmm.
And knowing what you know about experimental timelines, how long?
Yeah. So talking to the Google people, I get the impression that there is no fundamental, you know, there is no deep obstacle in going from 54 to 60. And you should expect that. And, you know. O of 1 years, okay, or, you know, maybe even, you know, maybe, you know, I mean, I think that they're actually working toward such things right now, okay, and then, you know, to get, you know, even 100 qubits, you know, that looks like, you know, in the pipeline, you know, doable. Now, you know, with superconducting chips, it looks very, very hard to scale beyond a few hundred qubits while maintaining good control and good coherence, right? And if you go beyond a few hundred qubits, that's the point where you're really, really going to want at least some error correction, or, you know, what's called error mitigation, right? And then, really the biggest milestone to look for will be like sort of the first useful use of error correction, let's say, in a full system like this one, to actually make things better than they were, rather than making them worse. Okay. And then once you can get full error correction, then you could integrate several such chips and you could scale to, you know, thousands of qubits and beyond. But that's, you know, I think that, you know, it will take years, you know, it could easily take a decade just to explore the era of, you know, a few hundred qubits and see what you can do there. Yeah.
So my question exactly related to the point that you raised just now. Nikolai and others have made this point that we can't expect to get scalable computers precisely because error correction is such a difficult problem.
Mm.
So what's your...
Well, I mean, Gil Kalai also said that you would never get quantum supremacy, right? He said that you would never outperform a classical computer, you know, for anything. And, you know, here's the interesting thing, the thing that I like about Gil Kalai among all the quantum computing skeptics, right? Now, you know, the easy thing for a skeptic to say at this point would be, well, of course you could do quantum supremacy, you know. No one ever said you couldn't do it. Well, you know, of course, you know, they did say it, but, you know, forget that, okay? You know, but that's just irrelevant. That's a sideshow. We all know that the real question is error correction, and until you've demonstrated error correction, you have nothing, right? That would be like if I were a quantum computing skeptic, that's certainly what I would be saying right now. Okay, that is not what Gil Kalai says. Gil Kalai says, look, if the Google experiment is correct, then it refutes my entire worldview. okay? My, you know, because, you know, this experiment directly, you know, is precisely what I predicted could never be done, you know? And so the only possible conclusion is that they must have made a mistake in the experiment. And so Gil has been every day like pestering Google for more raw data, okay, from their experiment, you know, CCing me, right? Google is like supplying him these giant data files, you know, and he's a pure mathematician. I don't know what he's gonna do with all of this, okay? But, you know, he'll find someone who knows how to code and you know, and he's gonna run his own checks on the data, you know, and he's repeatedly over the last couple months come up with, aha, here's the fatal problem. And then, you know, they answer him, no, actually, we took care of that. That's not an issue at all. And, oh, but it's this, you know, and so forth. Now, I think it's good for him to be doing this. You know, it is good for the field for some people to try as hard as they can to kill the result. And, you know, that is the way that science moves forward. That's how it's supposed to work. Personally, I would, rather than optimize for the good of the field, I would like to optimize for being personally right. But that's just me.
Okay, maybe one more question.
Yeah.
Or was there more? That's fine too. Okay, let's thank Scott again.